Windy City Queer Cast.
Gays and lesbians are all the rage.
We're here and we're queer.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
We're talking mega gay.
Ooh, I like that.
I'm Amy Matheny.
This program is brought to you in part by American Airlines, offering exciting GLBT vacations online at aa.com/rainbow.
And I let you in, made me feel like I was born again. You empowered me, you made me strong, built me up and I could do no wrong. I let down my guard, I fell into your arms, forgot who I was, I didn't hear the alarms. Now I'm down on my knees, alone in the dark. I was blind to your game, you fired a shot in my heart.
Listening to the Windy City Queer Cast, show number 612. I'm Amy Matheny, and it is February, the month of love. And man, are we loving being a community that is on fire? We have been talking for weeks and weeks. A few weeks ago, in January, the announcement was made that the Supreme Court will hear our conversation on marriage equality that has been loud and proud for so many years, but definitely the past 2 years for those of us in the Midwest and Illinois has really been a loud and pulsing beat of our community. And I'm really excited because for the next two episodes, I feel like it's a real privilege that I have with us on the show someone who has really been at the forefront in the middle of this entire marriage battle for us to gain ground and gain our equal ability to love who we want to love and be protected under all the laws and protections of our great United States. I'm talking about Mark Solomon. He is the National Campaign Director of Freedom to Marry. He has been a chief strategist for marriage equality on the front lines for the past decade, and his recent critically acclaimed book is the whole reason I couldn't wait to get him on the show. It's so good. It's called Winning Marriage, the inside story of how same-sex couples took on the politicians and pundits and won. And it is really an insider's account, so I'm thrilled to have him on. Not that it's book on tape, but I'm really excited to have the opportunity to do two shows with him about this entire lesson. And I feel like his book is really going to be a history lesson for the ages and is such a special perspective. So I'm thrilled to have Mark on the show. Hey, Mark, how are you?
I'm great, and I'm excited to be here with you.
I am too. It's an exciting time. You know, I've been working in LGBT radio since 1997. And so, you know, I kind of know when I remember talking about gay marriage coming on the scene when, you know, at the time we were the only daily gay radio show in the nation. And now it's so wonderful how we are able to access LGBT information and breaking news at, you know, with the internet. But when do you think this conversation about gay marriage began?
Well, it began, you know, it didn't begin at one points. There was a couple in Minnesota that actually went to get married in the 1970s. And there was a lawsuit filed, and they lost. Their lawsuit was booted out of court. But it really picked up in the 1990s when we won our first victory, in Hawaii, when a Hawaii, judge, ruled that, the Hawaii Supreme Court ruled that gays couldn't be discriminated against with respect to marriage, and there was a full-on trial. So it went up to the Supreme Court first, then it went back to the district court. The Supreme Court said, district court, you need to look at this, but we need to apply what's called strict scrutiny. And so they went and they conducted a full-on trial, and that's something that Evan Wolfson, who's my partner in crime here at Freedom to Marry, litigated with a local Hawaii attorney, and we prevailed after the trial. It ultimately was undermined or undone by a constitutional amendment. But that's when the real movement in the country began, when Evan and others started going around the country, particularly Evan, saying, look, this is not just a pipe dream. This is something that we can have, something that we can win. Mm-hmm. And the effort to first get our own community on board and then to make the case to others really started in earnest.
Well, and it's interesting because you're talking about that time period between, it was like 94 to 98 or 90, it's somewhere around there, I remember, right?
It was a number of years in the mid 90s. Yeah.
And I remember, you know, the story, it was so interesting. The story was centered in Hawaii. I mean, you know, it was like not even one of the contiguous, U.S. States. So,
exactly.
Can you take us back? Because as a historian, I mean, I really feel like you are a historian, just to kind of give us some reference, because we have a lot of younger listeners, too. You know, what was the climate nationally in the U.S., at that time for the LGBT community? You know, where were we as a community in terms of how mobilized we were? Was this, what were we really starting to fight for before the focus started turning to marriage so publicly?
Yeah, so we really were, we were fighting at the state level for laws to protect against discrimination in employment, in particular. For gay and lesbian people, there really wasn't much of a strong transgender equality movement yet. We were in the AIDS crisis. We were coming out of the AIDS crisis. And that's when a lot of people, for the first time, a lot of, non-gay Americans saw that gay people did have loving and committed relationships. They unfortunately learned that when they saw news clips of people caring for their partners who were dying of AIDS. So that is, that was a big part of the political activism in our community in the 80s and 90s, and that's what we were coming out of.
I really remember at that time because I was new to, I was kind of what's the word I'm looking for? Like, I never thought that I would have a life talking about LGBT issues. I mean, I came in an odd, circuitous way that I've been talking to LGBT people about all their stories. But I do remember at the time thinking there was a lot of controversy around, why is this our issue? I mean, we were still really dealing with just the things that came with HIV and AIDS, of not being able to visit your partner in a hospital, and we were worried about healthcare, for our communities, lesbian and primarily I think gay men with HIV AIDS, women with cancer, and smoking rates were really high, drinking rates were really high. I think it was, I just remember a lot of controversy around people going, why are we talking about marriage? Like, there's so many other things we need, right? And some people really knew that this was a key issue for us on a civil rights level. How do you think they identified that, folks like
Evan? I think it was really a grassroots effort. I've now worked on this cause now for more than a decade, mm-hmm. and as I've gone around and talked to people, before same-sex couples could marry anywhere, and then after we won the first court ruling in Massachusetts, What I found is that for regular same-sex couples, there is just a huge amount of passion around the idea of being able to get married.
Yeah.
And I think it's because marriage is such a rite of passage in our society. It doesn't mean that everybody needs to get married, but it does mean that if you are left out of the opportunity of getting married, you know, you're really a second-class citizen, and you, you know, this thing that you learn about, I mean, marriage is so ingrained in our society. You learn about growing up and getting, you know, getting married, and you know, from the nanosecond that you're born. And so for couples who had never been politically active before, all over the place, when they heard about and saw that there was a real chance that they might be able to marry, they got organized and they were willing to do things that, you know, that they weren't willing to do before for other pieces of our fight for to end discrimination against LGBT people.
Well, and it's interesting because it really ignited the religious right and the very ultra conservative sort of fundamentalists who felt that they, and continue to, me even today, feel like that there was a sanctity of this word, that marriage was somehow a religious institution first, before it's a civil institution, that really, I think, made this a loud conversation, I guess, for the community back then. And I remember some people thinking we don't need it to be that loud, and then others going, no, we need to be loud, and this is exactly the right conversation where people will have to see that we're just like everyone else. Is that how you kind of took it with because I sometimes felt like that the religious right kept this alive almost more than even our community did sometimes in the minds and ideas and the pipeline of American ideas?
Well, I think what happened is that while we were making the case for marriage in the places where we could win initially, and you know, in the Northeast in particular, our opponents viewed it as a very good political issue, and also there were some religious conservatives who were just strongly against, and so they used it as a real wedge issue in a number of southern states where, you know, the conversation really hadn't even begun yet about, you know, who gay couples are and why we want to marry and things like that. So I think it's true that our opponents were talking about it a lot in the context of political fights and in geographic areas that I thought would be helpful to them. But we also, I got involved first in Massachusetts as a volunteer in around 2001. And, we were organizing very actively in Massachusetts. And before then, in Vermont, Vermont ultimately settled on civil unions the first go around in 2000. But the lawsuit was to sue for marriage rights. And it is also very true that we were advocating for the right to be able to marry. It wasn't, it wasn't something that our opponents brought on, and we were, on their own, and we were just sort of fighting defensively. We were on the offense, and that's why our opponents responded.
So bring us a little to the part of your story. You just said a little bit that, you know, how you, because people would say, wow, if you've been fighting for this since 2000, 2001, you know, where does your passion and persistence for this idea or this fight stem from? I mean, you know, is it your lifelong dream to have been married when, you know, 2000 that you wanted that right, or you were so inspired by the two people who you dedicated this book to, who I know you were, so I'm kind of giving you an open,
sure.
But Evan Wolfson, who I interviewed many, many times in the 90s. I remember Mary and Evan often coming out of courtrooms and, you know, calling us from 4 to 6 on Les by Gay Radio and talking with us, and you dedicate the book to them. So talk to me just about really what tethered you to this fight for this decade plus, and where is it personal for you, and where has the passion stayed in some of these mentors and other people in this you know, in this with you, arm to arm?
Sure. So, you know, I'm a gay man, and I, you know, I've been involved in politics for, you know, for really for much of my life. I've been sort of a political junkie, and you know, I'd worked on Capitol Hill, and you know, I moved to Massachusetts to go to graduate school, and that's when the marriage battles. It's right around the time that GLAAD filed the lawsuit for marriage,
and that's the gay and lesbian
advocates and defenders. Yeah,
not the anti defamation, but the,
right, single A GLAAD as we call it,
single A GLAAD.
Right, and so they filed on behalf of seven couples. Seven couples went to their town clerk's offices. They were denied the freedom to marry, and GLAAD filed a lawsuit in 2001. And I guess I was so passionate about the cause. You know, in some ways it's hard to describe it. It felt so right to me. I'd been in, you know, it was around the period of time when a bunch of my friends were getting married. And, you know, I had the good fortune of being a groomsman and a best man in a bunch of weddings. And, you know, and they were sort of bittersweet experiences for me because on the one hand, I was very happy for my friends who were getting married. And on the other hand, it felt like, you know, it felt like it was something that I was just shut out of. And that just felt so wrong. And I also felt like if people could see who, you know, gay people and really are, that their attitudes towards LGBT people across the board would change, and that this conversation about marriage would be really 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 helpful for the community. And then I also remember thinking about the idea of young people and having a vision, young people having a vision of a future where they could marry, as being something that would be terribly important and really life-changing for young people who were recognizing that they were, you know, gay, lesbian. And, you know, and then, and I know we're going to talk about this, in a little bit, but, you know, then we won in Massachusetts in court, and I wanted to do everything that I could to protect that decision and make sure that it wasn't undone by the legislature, by our governor, Mitt Romney, you know, et cetera. So once we won for the first time in America, I needed, you know, I just felt compelled to do everything I could to help hold on to it.
Well, I know that it must have been so interesting to have come in once again, like unwittingly, didn't really know that you were at the very beginning of something so large and that would be so pivotal to your life and to so many of our lives. Talk to me about Massachusetts, looking back at the key players there that really helped and what in that battle made the difference to put us on the map.
Sure. Well, Massachusetts was first. It was the first time that we won and would see gay couples marrying. And we also had a huge fight in front of us because, you know, the second we won in court, literally, I remember this so well, I was broadcasting live on New England cable news as the decision came in, and I remember our opponents from every corner of the world, literally, were weighing in, from the Vatican to George W. Bush to then Governor Romney, but it wasn't just these conservative influences. It was also mainstream Democrats. I mean, I remember John Kerry, our then senator, came out in strong opposition to the court ruling and in support of a constitutional amendment to take it away, and that was the mainstream position among many Democrats. Mm-hmm. So we had to get to work immediately. And one of the things I remember so clearly was just how intense it was. I mean, I've now been involved in marriage fights in, you know, a dozens of states, and there's been nothing like the intensity of Massachusetts, when sort of religious right people came from every part of the country. And I remember people carrying giant crosses back and forth in front of the state capitol. And I remember the first day of marriages, there were sharpshooters on buildings all over the city of Boston, because we were concerned that something bad would happen. So, and then what we had to do, you know, necessity is the motherhood of invention. We had to put together a campaign to defend the decision. And that meant to stop a constitutional amendment. And so we organized like crazy to, you know, organizing couples and families to share their stories all over the states. And we got involved electorally to reelect our friends and to take out a few of our opponents. We knew that there would be nothing that would be more powerful in this fight than to show that a vote with us wasn't a job killer. It actually was a smart political vote as well as the smart moral and ethical vote. So it was really from the first day of marriages in Massachusetts in 2004 through June of 2007. It was it was a three-year battle to 3.5-year battle to defend the decision and ultimately win.
Well, and obviously one of the other key things that happened in that time was the changing of the guard with the governor. You go from having somebody who's in opposition to you to somebody who becomes a key ally for the community and for the fight. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because he's a big
sure. Yeah, there was. Yeah, when the day Governor Romney walked out of the governor's mansion or governor's office, and Deval Patrick, who wrote the foreword to my book and is a close friend, walked into the governor's office, was a huge day for equality for the state of Massachusetts. And he rolled his sleeves up immediately. And you never know what a political person is going to do when they get into office, because people oftentimes will tell you what you want to hear during an election, and then they'll have other priorities. And Deval Patrick immediately, even before he got into office, after he won, and before he was sworn in, he got to work making phone calls to lawmakers, asking me which lawmakers he should be calling and following through with them. And so he was a huge difference maker in this battle.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to break to give you all this week's news and what's going on in the arts and culture scene here in the Chicagoland area. But when we come back, I want to talk about whether or not the Massachusetts experience created a blueprint for kind of like what did you need when we head to the next key moment and also the next big part of your book, which is New York. So we'll be back with Mark Solomon after this.
I'm Kirk Williamson.
I'm Amy Matheny.
And this is the Week in News.
Ty Underwood, a 24-year-old transgender woman of color, was fatally shot early January 26th in North Tyler, Texas. The Tyler Police Department has offered a $1,000 reward for any information that leads to an arrest for Underwood's murder.
Idaho lawmakers have essentially killed a bill that would create protections for LGBT people, once again blocking attempts by gay rights supporters to amend the state's anti-discrimination law. The House State Affairs Committee, which includes some of the legislature's most conservative lawmakers, voted 13-4 to hold the bill in committee and prevent it from moving onto the House floor for a vote. Only Democrats voted in favor of the measure. The proposal would have included the words sexual orientation and gender identity in Idaho's Human Rights Act.
A Virginia legislative panel has killed a so-called conscience clause bill that would have allowed widespread discrimination against the LGBT community under the guise of religious freedom. The measure would have allowed private businesses to discriminate against homosexual behavior. The bill died in a House General Laws subcommittee after the five delegates sitting on the panel, all Republicans, unanimously voted to table the proposal.
New military discharge paperwork, known as Form DD-214, will be issued to three transgender veterans, reflecting their correct names and identities. safety veterans are retired Army First Sergeant, promotable, Dana Walker, retired Army Major Evan Young, and former Lieutenant Paula M. Nira, a Naval Academy graduate. Nira's win marks the first time the Navy has issued new paperwork for a transgender veteran.
In North Carolina, some Charlotte businesses are proposing protections for employees who are LGBT. The plan includes publicizing businesses that voluntarily provide protections, as well as trying to convince state lawmakers to require protection for employees. The proposal also calls for offering training for businesses on how to avoid workplace discrimination.
In response to Plano, Texas, approving an ordinance that prohibits discrimination against LGBT people, a Dallas lawmaker has filed a bill that would ban cities from enforcing such laws. State Senator Don Huffines, a Republican from Dallas, filed Senate Bill 343, which would amend the Texas Local Government Code to prohibit cities from enforcing ordinances that are not in conformity with state laws on the subject. The sweeping implications of the broadly worded bill would affect a wide range of non-LGBT-related city ordinances.
ExxonMobil's Equal Employment and Workplace Protection Policies finally will ban discrimination against LGBT employees. Many say ExxonMobil has made the change because President Obama issued an executive order last year prohibiting anti-LGBT discrimination among federal contractors, which includes Exxon.
Illinois Department of Human Rights Director Rocco Claps has been reappointed by Governor Bruce Rauner to continue in the position that he has held for the past 12 years. Claps was the first openly gay cabinet member in Illinois' history.
Google is deleting from its Google Translate program terms that define the word gay with homophobic slurs. The company was informed of the situation by a petition which read, "Imagine learning English and being taught to say hateful insults instead of neutral language for gay. When translating gay from English into Spanish, French, or Portuguese, Google Translate came back with terms like faggot, poof, fairy, and dyke as synonyms."
In world news, Brazil's largest city hopes to encourage trans youth to return to school and finish their education by offering them monthly payments. The program being offered by Sao Paulo's Municipal Human Rights and Citizenship Secretariat is intended to help transgender youth from having to turn to prostitution to support themselves. 100 students will receive about $325 a month if they attend 30 hours a week of middle and high school classes.
Italy took another small step forward in the fight for same-sex marriage as Rome's City Council Assembly gave approval to register for civil unions. Heart-shaped balloons were released after the vote, at which 32 approved, 10 opposed, and 1 abstained. The vote was backed by Rome's mayor, a longtime supporter of same-sex civil unions.
A Russian court convicted a journalist who set up a website to support LGBT teenagers under a controversial law banning gay propaganda aimed at minors. Thousands of teens use the social networking site called Children 404 to post accounts of realizing that they are gay and their experiences of coming out to family, friends, and teachers. The site's 26-year-old founder, Yelena Klimova, wrote on Facebook that a magistrate's court found her guilty of propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations among minors, and that she will appeal the fine of 50,000 rubles, or about $780.
In France, that country's highest appeals court allowed a gay man to marry his Moroccan partner despite the North African kingdom's refusal to recognize same-sex marriage. France legalized gay marriage in 2013. However, a 1981 agreement said marriages between French and Moroccan nationals were subject to the laws of their respective countries. The loophole was a clause in the agreement which stated that the law of one of the countries could be discarded when it violated fundamental rights.
In entertainment news, RuPaul's Drag Race will premiere its 7th season on Monday, March 2nd, and will include 2 new judges, Carson Kressley of Queer Eye for the Straight Guy and Chelsea Lately's Ross Matthews.
Kristen Wiig, Melissa McCarthy, Leslie Jones, and Kate McKinnon will star in the new all-female Ghostbusters reboot. The foursome will be filling the proton packs once wielded by Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Ernie Hudson, and the late Harold Ramis, stars of the first 2 Ghostbusters movies in the 1980s.
Tangerine, a new film that debuted at the Sundance Film Festival, has received attention not only for its content, but also for the way it was filmed, with the use of the iPhone 5S. the movie about transgender prostitutes in Hollywood and starring trans actress Maya Taylor in the lead role was shot with the Apple devices camera in widescreen.
Broadway veteran Joel Grey has officially come out as a gay man. Grey was married for 24 years, raised two children, actress Jennifer Grey of Dirty Dancing fame and Chef James. Grey, age 82, won an Oscar and Tony for his role in Cabaret. Now a photographer, Grey's next photo book will come out later this year, as will his upcoming memoir.
Megan Galbraith, 35, frontwoman of the queer Chicago punk trio 8-Inch Betsy, died January 22nd after a year-long illness. Galbraith and the band opened for The Gossip and toured with Amy Ray.
Transparent creator Jill Soloway drew fire from some members of the trans community after posting an image on her Facebook feed that appeared to take part in mocking Bruce Jenner's gender identity. She apologized, writing, "I made a mistake. It was horrible judgment. My complacency is checked and it won't happen again." Soloway's questionable post consisted of the original transparent publicity art in which all the characters' faces had been replaced with members of the Kardashian-Jenner clan. Bruce Jenner took the place of Jeffrey Tambor's Mark.
Speaking of, sources close to Bruce Jenner's family confirmed to People magazine that the former Olympian is preparing to live life as a woman and is reportedly filming his journey for a documentary series. Jenner and the matriarch of the Kardashian family, Kris Jenner, divorced after 22 years of marriage at the end of 2014.
HBO has greenlit a new period drama, Virtuoso, produced by couple Elton John and David Furnish and openly gay True Blood creator Alan Ball. The series will be set in 18th century Vienna and will follow a class of young musical prodigies at the prestigious Academy of Musical Excellence.
A former contemporary Christian country singer has resurfaced as a gay and HIV-positive folk singer. Singer-songwriter and pastor's son, Byron Rice, was a mainstay in the Nashville contemporary Christian music scene for about a decade under the name of Byron Keith. After getting married, having kids, and going through a divorce, Rice went on a hiatus from the music scene in 2005. He admitted that his divorce was caused by the fact that he had deep-held urges for other men, but said that his ex-wife has remained his friend.
And Rosie O'Donnell, A Heartfelt Stand-Up, will premiere Saturday, February 14th on HBO. The special showcases O'Donnell's comedic skills while incorporating a vital message literally near and dear to her heart. After her stand-up act, O'Donnell opens up about her life-changing 2012 medical emergency. The special airs throughout February and March on HBO and HBO 2.
And that's the weekend news brought to you by Windy City Times.
Hey, this is Levi Kreis, and you are on the Windy City Queercast.
Culture Club. Culture Club. Culture Club.
Theater.
Music.
Dance.
Art.
Performance.
Provocative.
Hilarious.
Exciting.
Weird.
Innovative.
Campy.
Edgy.
Original.
Get some culture in your life.
Join the club.
For the week of February 9th, 2015, you are in Chicago's Culture Club. A Red Orchid Theater toasts the start of 2015 with the smash hit Accidentally Like a Martyr by Grant James Vargas. Directed by Shade Murray, the flawless ensemble acting is highly recommended by the Sun-Times. And the Tribune says Accidentally Like a Martyr is a warm and potent show, well worth 80 minutes of your time. Now playing through March 1st with tickets and more at aredorchidtheater.org.
The smash Broadway hit and classic musical comedy La Cage aux Folles is now at the Marriott Theater in Lincolnshire, playing through March 29th. Feathers get ruffled and households upended in a poignant tale of one family's struggle to stay together, stay fabulous, and above all else, stay true to themselves. Visit MarriottTheater.com for tickets and more.
Award-winning Porchlight Music Theater presents the Chicago premiere of the hit Broadway review, Sondheim on Sondheim, February 6th through March 15th at stage 773. Do not miss the all-star cast performing songs from 19 Sondheim shows with video of the composer himself. For tickets and more information, visit porchlightmusictheater.org.
Steppenwolf Theater presents Marie Antoinette, a modern take on the young queen of France, called an unconventional, bitingly comic play, a jagged yet elegant historical riff by Time Out New York. Tickets are on sale now. Get your seats at steppenwolf.org.
Don't miss the American premiere of the scandalous new play, The Glass Protégé, a tale of a forbidden gay love affair between two male movie stars in the 1940s Hollywood, brought to you by Giant Cherry Productions in association with Glitterati Productions. From February 20th through March 29th, tickets available now from www.theaterwit.org.
And The Book of Mormon is the first great comedy of 2015. Join Pride Films and Plays and see what happens when two Mormons ring the doorbell of one Ethel Merman. Order tickets for the Jeff-nominated Book of Mormon at brownpapertickets.com through February 15th only.
And for more Culture Club, visit WindyCityTimes.com.
Hi there, this is Deb Pierce reminding you it's okay. Go ahead. You're not alone. Post a comment.
I know I'll never be the apple of your eye, but I'll pick you a flower if you're like. I know I'll never be the stars up in your sky, but I'll pick you a flower if you like. She loves me, she loves me not. She says she loves me, has she forgotten that she loves me? Love me one more time. I know I'll never be the apple of your eye, you a flower.
So we're talking with Mark Solomon. His new book is called Winning Marriage, the inside story of how same-sex couples took on politicians and pundits and won. And it's going to be a part of a two-part interview process that I'm having the pleasure of being with Mark for a couple of our shows. And we're kind of looking back at the history this week. And before we took a break for the news and some arts and culture, we were talking about Massachusetts and, you know, really, truly, you know, it's part of your title about the politicians and the pundits, but, you know, love them or hate them or whatever, but the politicians make the difference in a number of the stories, the right politicians who are on the right side of history. As we moved to New York, Mark, did you all learn something that became kind of a blueprint for what happened in Massachusetts, what was effective, what you needed to do to get it done in New York?
Yeah, I think we learned a few things. I think first and foremost, we learned that, you know, the truism that there's nothing more important for an elected official than to continue to be an elected official.
Right.
And if they think that voting your way is going to cost them their job, they won't vote your way.
Right.
And so you have to play electorally, and you have to show them that there is going to be a cost to a vote against you, at least for some. You know, you can't sort of try to take out every member who votes against you, but you can smartly target a few and make a real, you know, and win and make a huge difference that way.
And that was a lot, I think, of the debate, you know, sorry just to jump ahead, but that was a lot of the debate here on our home ground in Illinois with Madigan and when he felt like he could, you know, call for the vote. And it is interesting, this dance of, you know, like what you just said, you know, politicians are ruled by whether or not they can get elected again and what that means and what they have to do and how malleable they have to be. You know, when can they be bold and when are they cautious, you know, fearful for maintaining their position to where they can be effective on any issue?
And I think the answer is that very few of them are actually bold. Some of them are, and some of them, you know, some lawmakers in both parties have taken really courageous stances against their, you know, against what you might think of as their political best interests. But you know, if you're relying on a majority of politicians to do that, you're going to lose. So,
well, and you found one of those, I think, big surprises in New York in Andrew Cuomo, which is a really big part of that story. I mean, Deval Patrick, I think maybe you could have seen the writing on the wall. Was this one of the bigger surprises for you in the story and the fight for marriage equality?
Sure. Well, it was, I would say that his the strength of his support was a surprise. The fact that he didn't, you know, he said this very clearly. I don't just want to be the governor who, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't want to just be the governor who proposes marriage equality or supports marriage equality or gets it through one branch. I want to be the governor who signs it into law. And he made that a huge priority and put just his everything into it. And he is a brilliant, skilled politician at knowing every lever to pull with members on both sides of the aisle, knowing when to sort of be empathetic and when to push them hard and when to, you know, when to sort of chide them and how to sort of how to make it all work. Just very, very good at that. And we really got to, and I talk about this a lot in the book, in the section on New York, we really got a very hands-on sort of look at the way he operates. I spent two weeks in Albany the last 2 weeks of the legislative session in 2011 with him and with a few others, really working together on a daily basis to try to line up the votes and get us over the finish line. And
well, it's that misperception, right? That like, oh, New York, you think just New York City and you think, well, that's an easy win. Or Illinois, you think Chicago and you think that's an easy win. But, you know, we are really these major cities surrounded by a very different climate and a very different culture that make them interesting and challenging as an entire state.
We haven't had many, easy wins. I mean,
I think Iowa was kind of like, Iowa feels like it kind of like blew by our windscreens. Now, it may not for you, but Iowa kind of feels like it we all went, wait, what just happened? And then, because we all had our hand on another ball, I guess, on the court.
Yeah, no question. That was a biggie. We won in Iowa, and that was one of the early states, and certainly the first state away from the coasts to win. But in every state where we've won in the legislature or at the ballot, it's been by the skin of our teeth. New York, you know, we didn't know until the day of the final votes and a couple hours before the final votes. And it was, you know, a couple of vote majority win. And it was a Republican-led state Senate that we had to get the bill through. In Illinois, the day before the final vote, we were meeting in Craig Harris's office, the lead bill sponsor in the House, we were talking about, well, what happens if we're a couple of votes short? And so we were down to the wire in both New York and Illinois. It wasn't until the day of that we actually knew we had the votes lined up. And, we knew that Madigan was doing his thing by then and was counting his votes. We knew once it was really in his hands and he had taken it on that it was going to happen. But it was, it was nip and tuck for a long time.
What would you say? I mean, it's interesting because, like, we can kind of watch the trajectory of this president, of Obama, and, how he has changed, how he has grown in 6 years, and almost have a bit of a graph of what has happened to America on this issue. I would say mainstream America, of growing to understand, he has said that he has, I'm definitely paraphrasing here. You probably know his exact language, but that, he has come to understand more on this issue. He has come to change his stance on this issue. And to the point that we just heard a State of the Union in January where he even mentioned the word transgender. So obviously we are seeing the rapid growth, exponential growth of change that is happening from coast to coast here in the United States, almost in our leader. But has there been what you would think like that turning point? And I know the first state, Massachusetts, would be a turning point because if it can happen one place, it can happen somewhere else. But it feels like there became this cacophony, right? Where probably you were writing this book And it was things were changing so rapidly. You were like, I don't know when I can like send this to my publisher because the story is unfolding so rapidly every week. Do you identify one or a couple of major turning points that really sped this process up in the past handful of years?
Yeah, I think that has happened. And I think a couple of them, it's hard to identify one point, but I'd say there were a few,
Yeah, give us a few of those.
So I'd say certainly New York was a biggie because we hadn't won in a number of years, or we hadn't had a big win in a while.
Right.
And that was, New York's obviously a hugely important state. I think then the win at the ballots in 2012, the win, our opponents had always said that the one place where we'll never prevail is at the ballots.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, we did prevail 4 out of 4 times in Minnesota, Maryland, Maine, and Washington states. And that, that was a huge momentum boost.
And that feels so different, too, when we had all just had to go through the presidential election year, first term when Obama was elected, the bittersweet aspect of that night. I mean, I even know in Chicago here, because that was such a hard day at the ballots for us as LGBT people while we were also celebrating something so historic in his win. So, to see that just, a term later that, like you said, that we won at the ballot, that is huge about how much progress had happened in just 4 short years.
Yeah, no question. And, if you were going back a couple of years, I'd say Prop 8, the loss of Prop 8 in 2008 was also a huge turning point. I think it really was a wake-up call for the country. I think Obama's, as you were talking about, Obama's evolution and announcement was another big momentum boost. For the president is obviously just one guy, but the presidency really represents what the country's official position is in a lot of respects. And having President Obama talk about why he supported marriage in such a poignant for gay couples, in such a poignant way, and then putting the weight of the federal government on the side of equality was a really big deal. And then, no question, the victory at the Supreme Court on the Defense of Marriage Act and seeing the California marriage ban overturned, all of that was a huge momentum boost. So I'd say the period from sort of the end of 2012, when we won at the ballot 4 times, through through June of 2013, when we won those huge court victories, and we also won in 3 more states in Delaware, Rhode Island, and Minnesota. That was a really important period of time.
Yeah. Well, I'm really excited. That's actually a really good place for us to talk next week, because the Supreme Court is kind of where we will begin looking at Prop 8 and DOMA and the impact that had. And now here we are standing on the precipice of looking toward the Supreme Court again. The leaders, the judicial leaders of our United States, and hearing the cases of 4 cases challenging the state laws that are discriminating against same-sex couples, the Michigan, Ohio, Tennessee, and Kentucky hearing that will happen in April with a pending decision in June, supposedly. So, Mark, I am excited that you'll be back with me next week. I want to talk about the Supreme Court and talk about how I want to look forward and in the next show and talk about how we bring this home and what you and your organization are doing, and also how people can get involved, because the story is still writing itself, even though your book is done. I know you're probably going to write a part 2, right?
maybe an additional chapter, not a second volume, but another chapter.
Exactly. Really, I do believe this is such a fantastic book, and I'm thrilled to have Mark on again on the next show. It does have a foreword by Governor Deval Patrick, and the inside story of how same-sex couples took on the politicians and pundits and won. Winning Marriage is the name of the book, and Mark Solomon will be on with us again next week. And also coming up here following next week's show, it's Oscar time, the high holidays for us as gay people. We got the Tonys, we've got the Oscars, and then there's Gay Pride. But we will be looking at the Oscars and giving you the hot tips on that and who won and what were the big upsets in the following show as well. So Mark Solomon, we'll talk with you next week. Sound good?
Sounds great. Look forward to it.
All right. Have a great week, everyone. Thanks for listening to another Windy City Queercast. Special thanks to our Queercast family, Kirk Williamson, newscaster, and Di Sturkey, production editor. I'm Amy Matheny, your host. Please comment on our shows at WindyCityQueercast.com and iTunes. The next Queercast is only days away, so don't miss it. Subscribe today. Windy City Queercast, queer and now.